Good evening from Heathenstown, Pennsylvania. This is Doubting Dogma. I'm your host, Molly Ann Mormon, and with me is Riss McCool.
There are a lot of states in this country. I had no idea how many states there were in this country, but I've been to a lot of them this month.
I know. I can't look on Facebook without seeing you here and there on the, what is it, the Rissy tour of...
My queer purple tour across America. Yes. And I'll be going to Utah in June, so...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I
can't say anything. I'll be there in July,
Yeah. I will be invited to speak at Utah Pride, so I assume all seven people that'll be there will be stoked.
Awesome.
Indeed. And I just got back from Vermont today, and I did get maple syrup, and I am fulfilled. How are you, Molly?
Okay. I have a sore trigger finger from going to the range and shooting pistols at targets a lot.
There's a trigger warning joke in there somewhere, but I'm not that clever.
Well, business expense. So,
well, we missed a week, and we're sorry about that. And this episode's coming out late, so we're sorry about that too. But
yeah, it's been crazy between your driving all the way to Philly for school, my working crazy whacked out hours, and the Rissy tour.
Yeah. Of the two, I think you should definitely stop yours, but I get to stop mine in like 5 weeks, so it'll be finally done.
I would love to stop mine, but I have a mortgage to pay.
Mortgages are
and
dumb.
A car payment.
Also
and a
dumb.
Cell phone bill.
Very dumb. So
and
see,
rent.
We need all the Patreon dollars so she can stop doing all these dumb things.
Like taking money from the government.
Or taking advice from a podcast, yeah.
That too.
So last time we were on, we had a lengthy, lengthy discussion with Matthew Maxon, who I adore.
Yes.
Very precise, shall we say. we just kept trying to get him to elaborate a little bit, and every answer he had was like, this is how it is. I'm done. Like, Love you, Matt. You're awesome.
Yes, but Matt is...
Matthew, sorry.
Yes. Matthew is our first patron.
Besides me, you mean?
He was our first one. You were the second one. Beat you.
God, I lost out to Dan Irizarry and Matthew Maxon. God, what is with me coming in just behind friggin' opening arguments, patrons? I am disappointed.
So, big thank you to Matthew. And super awesome thank you to Riss. I love you.
Yeah, because really what I needed was more work. Another thing to do, because I've just been so bored lately.
I know. You just have so much free time.
I do. I just started my third book since November. So
yes.
I'm clearly prioritizing boredom and peace and quiet and relaxation and other things that I'm sure people do. I don't know how to people. I'm rather bad at it. And speaking of not...
People are overrated generally.
Yeah.
I have to deal with too many of them at work. And most of them are not the greatest people,
To be fair, you deal with a different lot of people at work than I deal with walking down streets with purple hair and being visibly queer. So
yeah.
I don't think I would get along with the people you work with for an entirely different reason.
Yes. No, I mean, well, my coworkers are of the far right variety.
My favorite.
I have to bite my tongue. And it gets interesting because, I mean, since I was raised in such a right leaning standing, we didn't lean right. We staked out the ground. That was it. Like I know where they're coming from with a lot of things, so I can empathize, but at the same time, I'm just like, can't you see what's going on? I just, that I don't understand. But then there's also the other people that we deal with that aren't exactly my coworkers, but the other employees there. And I find it interesting that a lot of them will talk to me that won't talk to the rest of my coworkers simply because I am the girl. So that gets interesting, but kind of creepy at the same time.
Yeah, and being the girl, I'm curious, what makes that different in your environment? Because I know what it does in mine.
Oh my gosh, they can be really crude just because of the line of work that it is. And with the military background, most of them are prior service and everything. And just being in that sort of environment brings out really crude and rough humor, because a lot of times, based on what you see, that is how you cope. So there's off-color jokes, there's language, I mean, that would make Noah and Eli blush. You
oh,
know?
I doubt that.
Well, yeah. But I mean, it's so rough, you know, just the speech and everything. And recently, my captain has been getting on everybody. If they start dropping F-bombs around me, he makes them apologize to me and everything. And it's funny, because where it all came from with that was one of the lieutenants, when he was giving his shift brief.
Mm-hmm.
This is completely off the record. Andrew, don't prosecute anyone. But when he was giving shift brief, he made some off-color jokes of the sucker swallow variety. And instead of just saying, oh, okay, sorry, that was out of line, you know, I apologize and moving on, you know, he thought he was funny and being cute or whatever and kept going back to it through his shift brief. And I'm like, it is one thing when you are out BSing with the guys and doing whatever on post, on patrol, whatever. And it's another when it's during shift brief and you are the shift supervisor giving the brief for the day before shift, and to do that kind of thing. And so I wrote a letter to my, or email to my captain, and it was like, this was inappropriate. Just so you know.
Yeah. I've got two things to add to that. One is, I don't think most of the people we're describing or talking about or having experiences with have bad intentions.
Yeah.
I really don't. But the other question I have is one I posted on Facebook a couple weeks ago when I was in Florida, and I got a little backlash to it because I don't think they understood the question. And that is, do certain jobs draw certain personality types, or do people act a certain way once they get there because that's what they see?
It's a mix.
Okay.
It is definitely a mix, especially in the military and law enforcement environment. I mean, take law enforcement, because I mean, with everything going on, you get those that genuinely want to help the community. Mm-hmm. So they take this job so they can help out, so they can do good things, not just be a ticket Nazi, right? And then you get others that have the small dick syndrome. They've got the Napoleon complex. They just want to freaking prove that they are the alpha to end all alphas. And so they take that job because it puts them in a position of power, and then they abuse it.
I see. The reason I thought of it was because I was behind a tow truck, and it had a whole bunch of pro-Trump stickers, and I thought, well, there's a surprise. And I caught myself doing that. I said, okay, why am I not surprised by that? And who would be surprised by that? And why does that work? Why does it, you know, I'm not even just talking to military. I get the military. That makes sense. But like auto mechanic, or, you know, when an auto mechanic says something like that, you're not surprised. Or if a Starbucks barista says something super, super alt-right, you are. I mean, what do you think it is?
I mean, it goes back to, I think it goes a lot to Hollywood and the preconceived notions that they put out that we see in the media all the time. You know, you've got the the stereotypical, well, and that's where they came from, the stereotypes that, and they reinforce them through the media. And so you're always seeing, okay, the barista is this little gay guy and he wants to do this and just, you know, and then you've got Pastor Manning saying that they're putting the semen in the lattes, right? So so, I mean, you get certain stereotypes that show up. So then you, even if you're not consciously equating those, when you see it, you're just like, well, yeah, that's how it is. And so certain blue collar jobs, you know, tow truck driver, mechanic, you know, whatever, you assume are less educated individuals, and so therefore, you know, they're Bible thumping.
Sure.
I'm gonna vote for a rapist guy.
Right, right. And I wanna state for the record, I don't necessarily believe in these stereotypes, but we all fall prey to them sometimes. But I guess the key is not having disrespect for jobs. I think that's the micro narrative is,
oh, I love him to bits. He's awesome.
But yeah. But I really agree with him that we need to stop disrespecting a lot of jobs in this country. And I think a lot of the social problems we have comes from the way we treat certain workers. Not we in this room, but as a general society. Fast food people, retail workers, janitors, construction workers. Yeah. I wonder what that is.
I mean, construction workers can make a lot more than I do as a little government employee, you know? And it's crazy the amount they can get. And some of them are a lot more educated than me because I don't even have an associate's, you know? I skipped through on the military and then just hopped on over to government work. So I cheated. I sincerely, like, that's how I feel. I'm like, I cheated my way to this, and now I'm, like, stuck here because I don't have a degree, so I'm like, my career's not moving anywhere, and I get depressed and want to cry.
Well, I need a tissue.
No,
I feel bad bringing this up again because I've recorded about it on 2 straight episodes of Inciting Incident, but that comment that I got recently, just this conversation brings me back to the fact that this is a Trump-voting white guy who, in addition to telling me what the career experience is, as you know, he would know, said that I have no tangible skills and a lazy work ethic. And I went off on the lazy work ethic thing.
I do believe I saw that comment.
Right. And, you know, both Inciting Incidents episode 85 and 86 are me ranting and then me bitching about cis people with Ari, present company excluded. So I want to go back to the tangible skills thing because there's a lot of workplace elitism that goes on both sides. And when someone sees what we're doing right now or sees me writing a book or, you know, sees an artist in general, they assume that they do that because they can't get a real job or because they're not qualified to do anything else or because they don't know how to do anything else. And that's not helped by the fact that I hear artists and stand-up comedians and everything all the time say, it's a good thing this art worked out because I couldn't do anything else. But I had 17 years of work experience before this shit took off. Mm-hmm. And it's hard not to go, how dare you? For many reasons, but to say I have no tangible skills? I've worked in management. I've worked for major companies. Like I worked for Nordstrom. That was a big deal. I've worked for a college football team. So what is it about that? Again, we're working with stereotypes here. What is with this workplace elitism in the sense that there's a whole group of people who feel that they are the real Americans who have the real jobs, and then there's another group of people who look down on those people without realizing it. And sometimes they bleed to both. I'm not denying that at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's those that they feel they're better than everybody simply because they have the fancy paper that they hang up on their office wall and they don't have to get their hands dirty. So therefore they're better and they are living the American dream because they're working their way up through some company that doesn't give two damns about them and doesn't even know who they are until they reach the board level or whatever.
Looks like we made it.
And then, you know, there's those that open their own business and it's something that they do actually get their hands dirty and it's something that no one else wants to do for whatever reason, you know, and like those people are really to be commended though, yeah. Because some of them have really crappy jobs, no pun intended, Mr. Sewage Worker.
But yeah, I'm glad they get their hands dirty because I ain't doing it. I got nothing but respect for them.
I'll get stuck in my nails.
One of the things my parents taught me from a very young age was treat the janitor the same way you would treat the CEO. And I feel that's important. And I feel like we've lost a lot of that. Because I remember growing up, I don't know if it was the same for you, in crazy church stuff. But did they ever say you need to get educated or else you'll end up flipping burgers at McDonald's? Did you ever hear any of that? Because I heard it constantly.
I think part of this is a little different because I grew up as a girl and you were a young man grown up and they always said, well, you know, because it's traditionally, oh, it's the man's job to whatever. And I had this mindset even when I was in the Army that, well, once I get married, then I can stay home. I can go to college. I can get a degree because that's the way it's supposed to be.
I see.
You know? And I mean, yeah, I heard some of that. And my dad was disappointed, like when I dropped out of college, because at that point, you know, I was the one who had been going the longest. And he was so sad that he didn't have a child who was a college graduate yet, though my little sister took care of that. So, you know. But it was, I don't know. I think the pressures for girls is a lot different, especially in uber religious households like mine growing up versus for boys as far as the jobs and workplace and everything. And you have to get your education because you need to go and get a good job so you can support the little wife and family, you know, because you're supposed to be the breadwinner.
Yeah, I got a lot of that in relationships. I can remember one specifically about 6 or 7 years ago where I was just starting to come into my own as a feminine person. I wasn't quite to realizing myself again the way I had in high school before they beat it out of me, but I can just remember the breakup fight going, you know, I need a protector. I need a breadwinner. And I'm like, we never discussed that. Like I was so befuddled because it's like, I never really hid the fact that I'm like really feminine and not into stereotypical gender roles. So what the fuck? And then she married my best friend and now both of them don't talk to me. So, well, one of my best friends, I should say, because my other one's in the room right now. Hi. Or now he's a soul winner. So, yeah,
well,
I'm talking myself
loss.
In circles here. I love you all. I love everybody, but Brian's put in the most service, so he gets the most credit. He's had to put up with me for like 20 years. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I can remember when he was talking about a person, his college roommate, who was Colin and is now Serafina. I can remember even back then going, like it was like, oh, that is a thing? Really? You don't say. And then I saw how your parents reacted to it. I'm like, oh, maybe not. They weren't mean about it. I can say that. They were not mean about it.
Do you want me to come over and contribute?
Sure. Come on over. All the way over from Inciting Incident, Brian the Fuzzy.
Yes.
Hi, I'm in the room as well. No, I don't have any much to add on that subject other than my folks were, they tend to take a lot of things in great stride, and they've done so with you now, Marissa, so you can rest assured that our family still loves you.
Yay!
And I think that's an interesting perspective, having a friend, a close friend, not just you, but Sarah, and she's not the first transgendered friend that I had, even in college, so I guess that's part of the process of not hating something is not being afraid of it.
Yeah.
and actually realizing, oh, these people are people.
Yeah.
What a shock. Anyway, yes, carry on.
Thank you. Yay.
I'm helping.
Yeah, and he brings up a good point because I think a lot of what's going on is the fear and the demonization of what they don't understand.
Yeah, like driving around a bus that says we're not people, and then being surprised when someone vandalizes it, and then go, hey, let's have a civil argument. Well, you decorated a bus saying we're not people. Civil argument was clearly not in your motivation. You expected everybody to flurry out of their homes and press aside this political correctness and agree with you that we're not people after all. And instead, you got a rock through your window and someone writing trans liberation on your bus because fuck you, you tangerine fucktard bus. And I use the word fucktard because you guys use it and I'm turning it back around against you just like you do with slurs with me. Go fuck yourselves. Anyway.
I love your wrist.
You just like saying fuck.
I do. I do. I often joke.
Especially in reference to our tangerine in chief.
Yeah. I always joke with my husband, my girlfriends. Yes, girlfriends. I always joke with them, and even with Andrew Torres recently. I don't get it. Like, Andrew said I was an inspiration, and I just went, I'm just a college girl who says fuck a lot. So, I mean, it's... And then he got two over on me because he's a damn Harvard lawyer. But he goes, I don't have time to argue with you because I have to go, but you're wrong. I'm like, fuck! Oh, and I was on Lot Awful Movies this weekend, so that was an experience.
Oh, that's awesome.
Have you ever tried to be funny on a podcast where one's a Harvard lawyer and the other one is used to only talking to him? Yeah, so I had a great time on Lot Awful Movies, and I had 6 pages of notes, and I got to say like 20% of them. we were reviewing the movie, and for Time's Up, just sitting there going, "This is interesting. There's absolutely no place for me to get in here."
I guess they don't map it out quite the same way that Noah, Heath, and Eli do. Huh?
No, Noah, Heath, and Eli sort of tailor their review to bring you into it and feature you and make you have the good jokes. Thomas and Andrew are so used to playing off of each other that sometimes they forget there's someone else in the room. Like I said, I had a great time. It was a whole lot of fun. I hope it'll be really funny. But there was one point I turned to Jeannie and just said, drink. Like, I need a drink. And not just because we reviewed the first episode of Chicago Justice. Oh, God. I'll just say, it's a 43-minute episode. Our episode went 2 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, yeah, we had a point at one point, I think.
I don't even know what it was.
I don't either. So, something about semen in the lattes. I'm not sure. Yes, I win.
Payback, huh?
So, speaking of semen and the lattes, you brought along a mini Book of Mormon here.
Yes, this is the one that I carried in basic training in my cargo pocket.
And just
back when I was super Mormon.
Oh, well, this should help enhance the flavor a little bit. And I realize that's a bad phrase to use when I've just been talking about semen and the lattes. But roll with me here.
Extra foam. No,
I just. I have completed the quadruple movie review podcast thing. I have been on God Awful Movies. Is this real life? Lot Awful Movies and Utah Outcast reviewing Mormon movies. And last week I got to review Saturday's Warrior live without having seen it first.
I don't know that I've seen that one.
Well, brief,
or even heard of it.
Brief synopsis. It's a 1989 stage play turned into a movie with people who are clearly not actors. As they're all, the movie starts in pre-heaven or whatever it's called.
Pre-mortal life.
Yeah. And they all are talking to each other. For some reason, they're all different ages. You know, like you do. And that, you know, they're like, are we going to meet up in real life? Like, am I going to remember you and all this? And the little girl's biggest fear is that she's going to get aborted.
Nice.
Yeah. And the bad kids of the movie want to save the environment. So, yeah.
Well, because, you know, the second coming, which is when Christ comes back, is going to be before the earth, like, roast itself to death. And so therefore the environment doesn't matter.
Oh, so yeah. But we're not going to be here, so fuck
that's it. That's exactly the reasoning behind it. Like, they don't actually come out and say it, but that is the spirit behind it.
I hate everything.
Because, let's see, one of the prophets, well, sorry, let me amend that. One of the presidents of the church, back around the, I want to say in the 20s or 30s, I believe it was David O. McKay, said something about that there were people alive at that time who would be alive when Christ returned, right? So basically saying somebody who is at this moment alive is going to be here when the second coming happens, and so therefore, you know, it's within our lifetime. Yeah, that was, golly, what, 80 years ago?
Yeah, they've been wrong a couple times.
I'd have to check and see, you know, and even as a kid, they were saying, yeah, so, I mean, he could have been talking about, you know, the little primary school kids and, you know, because they were alive. And so they're going to be a lot older now, obviously, but, you know, still in their lifetime. And
yeah. And just a note on that, you should totally be like a $1 patron or something to Utah Outcast, just so you can review my experience of seeing a Mormon movie.
Okay. I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah. Utah Outcast. I was on it. Go patronize them because they invited me out to Utah and they've been super cool to me. Anyway, your book.
That always cracks me up, saying patronize them.
Yes. patronize us, then patronize them, but patronize them so you can hear me suffer, getting increasingly more drunk, watching a Mormon stage play where the revealing outfits involved seeing shoulders. Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Well, like my wedding dress, my mom-in-law and I used to joke around about how my dad was going to freak out because my shoulders were exposed and I was going to drive all the men to lustful thoughts.
Well,
shoulders.
It worked on me, but I'm not a man, so just, you know. And it worked on Eli, but everything does.
I didn't even see Eli at the wedding.
Of course
Where
not.
Where did you hide him?
There were a lot of woods in more ways than one. Prank war.
Oh, it's bad. I was just listening to their two episodes of Vulgarity for Charity while I was driving around today, and oh, I was literally in tears, just laughing so hard, and I kept thinking, when are they doing another one? Because there's a couple people I need them to insult. Like, sincerely, not roast. I mean, absolutely insult. And yeah.
Oh, you mean like a certain Eli did for a certain...
For a certain risk.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Not risk, but...
Yeah. Okay. I noticed that too, but...
Yeah. So yeah. Last time we were trying to talk about the Book of Mormon, wasn't Joseph just about to hit people or something? Like, there were plates.
He had recovered the plates, in quotations. I've been listening to some of the...
Scathing?
No, well, that too.
Naked Mormonism?
That one. And so, yes, those who have read my blog have gotten my disclaimer. I apparently was completely wrong about Joseph sticking his head in a hat.
Oh.
Because
that makes the difference.
Well, that and on Scathing, one of their past episodes, because back catalog and all that, they mentioned that the Mormon Church had released pictures of Joseph Searstone. And I was like, what? And so I looked it up, and yeah, it's this egg-shaped brown river rock that he had before he had the plates. And he apparently used to stick it in a hat, stick his face in the hat so that no light came in. And then, like, that's how he saw stuff, right? And this is how he knew where to find the plates and all this other crap.
And then he adopted Curious George and they went on merry adventures.
Yeah, and it's...
Because that's how storybooks should end as far as I'm
just,
concerned.
I mean, it's interesting that this documented and known by the church history was never talked about during church. This was the first I had ever heard of this. And I always thought that South Park was just exaggerating like they do. I didn't ever think that they were actually being completely truthful. But yeah, I was just completely blown away by that, because as the church narrative goes, the official thing that you will learn at church if you go to Mormon church is that, you know, he finds the plates. With it is the Urim and Thummim, which are the seer stones, which were apparently fastened such and such and something about a breastplate and whatever. And he used that to translate, like he had to put that on. And then he would have the plates in front of him. And there was like a curtain between him and whoever was scribing for him. That's the official, right? And that the further along in the translation he got, the less he needed to use the Urim and Thummim, because he was that much more in touch with God.
He was Mormoning better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even though the church wasn't a thing yet. But apparently, no. Like, sometimes the plates weren't even there, or they were completely covered up, and he wasn't looking at them, and he had his face in a hat, and he was talking like this, you know? And I just, the more I learn, the more I'm like, how, what, I don't understand.
I don't either. And, you know,
I'm like, how is this a thing?
Yeah, but you have to imagine my perspective of seeing someone
years,
who
is this a thing?
Clearly intelligent and reasonable and rational, who used to believe this stuff. No offense.
Oh my gosh. And yeah, I mean, I was literally just, that was it. I was such an uppity freaking Book of Mormon up my ass freaking person.
I shouldn't touch that. Okay.
I mean, it was just, that was so just the thing, and everyone else was wrong, and let me get you a copy from the missionaries and this kind of thing. And I mean, it's,
can I do a dramatic reading?
Sure.
Yeah, just pull up to our end.
Okay, where are you at?
Chapter 3, Helaman,
yes.
Helaman? Okay. Many neophytes migrate to the land northward, hyphen. They build houses of cement and keep many records, hyphen. Tens of thousands are converted and baptized, hyphen. The word of God leads men to salvation, hyphen. Nephi, the son of Helaman?
Helaman.
Helaman fills the judgment seat. And now it came to pass, in the 43rd year of the reign of the judges, there was no contention among the people of Nephi, save it were a little pride which was in the church. That's a sentence, apparently. And no, that's not even a sentence. That's a fragment.
Well,
which, what?
What do you want? It was, quote unquote, written by someone third grade-ish education.
Yeah, let me start this sentence over again, because I need to clarify this is all one sentence. And now it came to pass, in the 43rd year of the reign of the judges, there was no contention among the people of Nephi, save it were a little pride which was in the church, which did cause some little dissensions among the people, which affairs were settled in the ending of the 43rd year. Excuse me.
As I've been reading this, and you can see where I'm at here. Here's where I'm at. I started, what, the end of January, I want to say. So, I mean, I'm a good, like, quarter or third through. But I have noticed he is super repetitive. Like, there was a verse that literally, it said this and this and this, and then said to the word exactly the same thing right after. And I was like, what is the point of that? I don't get it.
It's almost like he was making this shit up.
I know.
Number two, And there was no contention among the people in the 44th year. Neither there was much contention in the 45th year. Good news. Number three. And it came to pass, in the 46th, yea, there was much contention and many dissensions in the which there were an exceedingly great many who departed out of the land of Zarahemla, yes, and went forth unto the land, quote, no, that's not, is that a quote? Yep, I think it is. Northward to inherit the land, there's no unquote. What the fuck?
Well, okay. Slightly in Joseph's defense, the first draft of this, when it was written, there was no punctuation at all because Joseph didn't specify any punctuation. And so when it first went to print, it was the publishers that put punctuation in.
So God hates punctuation. Got it.
Or there's just an illiterate guy who's doesn't know a comma from a semicolon.
And they did travel to an exceedingly great distance, insomuch that they came to, quote, large bodies of water and many rivers. Again, no unquote. Five, yea, and though they did spread forth into all parts of the land, into whatever parts it had not been rendered desolate and without timber, because of the many inhabitants who had before inherited the land. I can't make this shit up. Six, and now no part of the land was desolate, save it were for timber, but because of the greatness of the, quote, destruction of the people who had before inhabited the land, it was called desolate. Seven, God, this guy begins everything with and. And there being but little timber upon the face of the land, nevertheless people who went forth and became exceedingly, quote, expert in the working of cement, therefore they did build houses of cement in which they did dwell. Eight, and it came to pass that they did multiply and spread and did go forth from the land southward to the land northward and did spread in so much that they began to cover the face of the whole earth from the sea to the sea south to the sea north, from the sea west to the sea east. Nine, and the people who were in the land northward did dwell in tents and in houses of cement, and they did suffer whatsoever tree should spring up on the face of the land, that it should grow up, that in time they might have timber to build their houses, yea, their cities, and their temples, and their synagogues, and their sanctuaries, and all manner of their buildings. 10. And it came to pass.
Well, yes. If you take out and it came to pass, you'd have a pamphlet. And hang on real quick. Did I hear you say that they lived in tents of cement?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a thing.
Okay.
And it came to pass, as timber was exceedingly scarce in the land northward, they did send forth much by the way of shipping. Really?
It must be North Dakota.
Yeah. That must be what that Standing Rock thing's about.
They sailed it north across the plains on the seas of bison, I guess.
I want to see a sea of bison. I want to see them operate like a school of fish or something, just moving around all simultaneous, like transportation in the Mormon times.
I've almost seen that in Yellowstone because they have huge herds of them there.
Wow.
But nothing like it used to be.
And thus they did enable the people in the land northward that they might build many cities, both of wood and of cement. Ooh, we're getting classy now.
Fancy.
12. And it came to pass that there were many of the people of Ammon who were Lamanites by birth, did also go forth into this land. And now there are many records kept of the proceedings of this people by many of this people, which are particular and very large concerning them. But behold, a hundredth part of the proceedings of this people, yea, the account of the Lamanites and of the Nephites and their wars and contentions and dissensions and their preaching and their prophecies and their shipping and their building of ships and their building of temples and of synagogues and of their sanctuaries and their righteousness and their wickedness and their murders and their robbings and their plundering and all manner of abomination and whoredoms cannot be contained in this work. But apparently it can be contained in one fucking sentence.
And I love how he always goes on and he's like, yeah, and this is the record of such and such, and we had all this great stuff, but we're not going to get into that. Instead, I'm going to just tell you that we had that, and then we're not going to say that, but I'm going to actually write that down because that's worth it on these plates of metal because there's so much room here, and so I'm not going to write that, but we had it.
You know, I got to say the funniest thing about reading this is you watching going, yeah, that's how it goes, and Brian going, what in the absolute fuck?
He looks so incredibly happy to have never been Mormon.
Peek over your shoulder, Riz, as you were reading it to make sure you were reading it correctly and I was not having a stroke over the sheer amount of run-on. Holy fucking Christ.
But behold, there are many books and many records of every kind, and they have been kept chiefly by the Nephites. Ooh. And they have been handed down from one generation to another by the Nephites, even until they have fallen into transgression and have been murdered, plundered, and hunted, and driven forth, and slain, and scattered upon the face of the earth, and mixed with the Lamanites, until there are no more called the Nephites, becoming wicked and wild and ferocious, yea, even becoming Lamanites. Fuck you, Lamanites. And now I return again to mine account. Therefore, what I have spoken had passed. Well, that I would assume so. Had passed after there had been great contentions and disturbances and wars and dissensions.
And rumors of wars.
Among the people of Nephi.
Oh, he didn't include the rumors of wars?
No.
That's a common theme. It'll always say, and there something, something. There are wars and rumors of wars, and it's very common in there. There's a whole bunch of war.
And keep in mind, this is all, I haven't turned a page yet, just saying. The 46th year of the reign of the judges ended, -19, and it came to pass that there was still great contention in the land, yea, even in the 47th year, and also in the 48th year. Nevertheless, Helaman did fill the judgment hyphen seat with justice and equity. Yea, he did observe to keep the statutes and the judgments and the commandments of God, and he did do that which was right in the sight of God continually, and he did walk after the ways of his father, insomuch that he did prosper in the land. And it came to pass that he had two sons. He gave unto... Oh, a period! Holy shit, a sentence ending! And he gave unto the eldest the name of Nephi, and unto the youngest of Lehi, and they began to grow up unto the Lord. And it came to pass that the wars and contentions began to cease in a small degree among the people of the Nephites in the latter end of the 48th year. Of course, in the reign of the judges over the people of Nephi, and it came to fucking pass in the 49th year of the reign of the judges.
I want that version.
There was, let's do the Samuel L. Jackson version. There was fucking continual space and peace established in the land, all save it were for the secret combinations which Gadianton the robber had established the
robbers.
Fucking land, which at the same time were not known unto those who were at the head of the fucking government. Therefore, they were not destroyed out of this land. Let's get all these motherfucking people out of this motherfucking land. And it came to pass... Of course it did. that in this same year there were there was exceedingly great prosperity in the church, insomuch that there were thousands who did join themselves unto the church and were baptized into repentance. Fuck this book! Oh my God! That was all one sentence, I think. So, how did he convince people of this? Please tell me.
I don't know. I was born into it. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, I'm...
I was brainwashed from birth.
Yeah, that I understand. You know, the same thing goes on with Scientology. But there was a recent show that decided to include Mormons because it was about westward expansion, and it portrayed Brigham Young as this very snappy, very articulate, very knowing man who just scowled and manipulated. And then I'm reading that going, and he went with the guy who wrote this. Okay.
Yeah, and here's the interesting story, according to the church, right, on how Brigham Young became the second president of the church, because there wasn't, at the time, a set... hierarchical way that it would get passed down. And I guess Emma, Joseph Smith's first wife, thought that it should go to his son, kind of like a monarchy or whatever. But it was never established. And according to the official church stuff, how it's taught at church, was one Sunday or whatever, Brigham Young got up to address the church, and he's there giving his spiel or whatever, his little sermon or whatever you want to call it. And he was transformed by the Spirit to look like Joseph Smith. And everybody was like, oh, God says that Brigham Young is going to be the next prophet. It's clear because he looks like Brother Joseph. So that is how, according to the church, Brigham Young became the second president.
Okay, then. It sounds like he was almost like, well, this is bullshit. I wonder if this will... Holy shit, it worked.
I will just want to know how many shrooms they passed around before the service.
Oh my God, yes. That sounds phenomenal.
These schnozberries taste like schnozberries.
Or however Mormons would call it. So he has the seer stones, and then there was that part where one of his friends was like, hey, do this thing, and then tried to do the thing, and it's like, no, God's mad at you for letting
me. Oh, right. Yeah, Martin Harris. He wanted to take the translation to a scholar and have him look it over. And so Joseph, I guess, transcribed some of the characters onto one sheet and finally let him take 116 pages. Now, this was the Book of Lehi, which Lehi was the first prophet in the Book of Mormon, right? And it was his family that left Jerusalem. Though where the Book of Mormon picks up is with Nephi, who is Lehi's son, you know, because once these pages were lost, God told Joseph not to translate them again because whoever had the pages could alter them, so then his translation would look false.
Ah.
Say...
What a coincidence.
Or he just couldn't remember whatever he wrote for the 116 pages. It would be different, obviously.
Something, it came to pass.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was of curious workmanship. There, see, I could have written this book.
Yes, which that was actually the Liahona was the name of that compass that was of curious workmanship that got the text messages from God and sent him around.
That would have made a much better story. Hey, look, I have this design of curious workmanship, and it says Apple on the back. Is this from the future? Yes, it is, Joseph.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, I guess when Joseph prayed about taking the that translation and letting Martin Harris take him, he was told no. And so he prayed again, and he was told no. And he prayed again, and finally, you know, God was like, whatever, do whatever you want, because you obviously ain't listening to me, kind of like your parents when you keep nagging them as a kid, you know? Can I have a cookie? Can I have a cookie? Fine, eat the whole thing, you know, yeah, whatever.
Whatever, just so, shut up.
So finally, you know, okay, whatever, do what you want. So here's these 116 pages. Here's this little copy of some of the characters from the plates. And Martin Harris took them to a scholar at the local university there, and I don't remember his name. It's not there on the tip of my brain, so I can't recall. But according to Martin Harris, this professor said that it was the most accurate of any translation he'd ever seen. But I heard on the Naked Mormon, the Naked Mormonism podcast, like, he read the letter, or he read an account written by this professor that said it was gobbledygook. It was just, it was rubbish. It was just, like, weird characters and squiggles. It didn't mean anything.
I can't imagine that after reading 25 sections.
Verses that was all one sentence?
Yeah. And lots of, and there was, and there was, and there was, and the
and there
list.
Came to pass and a came whole to pass. Bunch.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that should be a thing. I think every episode we should have part of it where I read part of that book in disbelief.
Absolutely. I will have it because, I mean, I carry it around with me at work, so if I have some off time, I can read a little bit and kind of snicker. Oh, where was this one? I wrote a blog about one of these, so those who have read my blog, I apologize if I get a little redundant here. Oh, where did I?
Doubting Dogma blog.
I know.
The blog that inspired the podcast.
Here, let me find the let me find the verse.
Yep. And I'll just, you know, real kill quick. Time here while you find the
it
thing.
It was 2 Nephi 9.
2 Nephi.
2 Nephi. Chapter 9, verse 28. Okay. Is this the right one? 35. Yeah, so, oh, that cunning plan of the evil one. Oh, the vainness and the frailties and the foolishness of men. When they are learned, they think they are wise.
Yeah, that's kind of what it means.
And they that hearken not unto the counsel of God, for they set it aside, supposing they know of themselves, wherefore their wisdom is foolishness, and it profiteth them not, and they shall perish. So, literally, God forbid that you get schooling.
Yeah, otherwise you'll die.
Learning is of the devil.
Of course.
And, yeah, but
be
to
stupid
be learned
and multiply.
Is good if they hearken unto the counsel of God. And woe unto the rich, and
blessed be anyone named Joseph.
Woe unto the deaf that will not hear, for they shall perish.
Okay.
Yeah.
He loves
woe
to
unto
kill
the
people.
Blind that will not see, for they shall perish also. And of course, the footnotes to that, of course, they're going to justify saying, well, that's, you know, spiritual blindness, spiritual deafness, that you won't listen or pay attention to the prophets,
uh-huh,
and blah, blah, blah.
That's what it was.
Woe unto the uncircumcised of heart.
What the... what?
For a knowledge of their iniquities shall smite them at the last day.
What the fuck
hang
does
on,
that
hang
mean?
On. I don't know. Let's see. Okay. So, well, it sends us over to Romans, and I don't have my Bible with me. Yeah. I don't know. I guess that they're... Since circumcision was a, I guess, holy, well, a, not holy, but I guess since it was an identifier among the Jews, that I guess if your heart was quote unquote not circumcised, I guess not literally, obviously, because
no, I think it is literally. I think they're saying cut off, don't cut out your heart or you will die. They got something right.
I don't think it means what you think it means.
This is just going to be the rest of the Doubting Dogma podcast, us reading parts from this book. And it's not even ripping someone off because it, at least they're the scathing guys are reenacting it. We're just reading it. It's like, yes, this is a real thing.
Yeah, yeah. Though David Michael did do that already, but,
Hank,
you know, well.
Is he in this room?
This is different. No.
Exactly.
Hang on. Woe unto the murderer who deliberately killeth, for he shall die.
Okay.
So they're saying basically capital punishment is the thing right there.
That's one of the only clear things I've gotten out of this shit.
Woe unto them who commit whoredoms.
Well, I'm screwed.
Oh, you're going to be thrust into hell.
Yay. Because it's the pelvic thrust that really drives you insane.
That's part of the whoredoms.
Let's do the Mormon warp again, baby.
So, yeah. And like when I read that verse 28 about the woe unto he that is learned, for he's actually stupid or whatever, thinks he has wisdom and is foolish. Or something. I was like, what? What?
So we're almost out of time here. So next time on the Doubting Dogma podcast, what comes after Joseph Smith being like, nah, that didn't happen? Preview.
Which part didn't happen?
That book in Nephi. Oh, God says he's mad.
Oh, yeah.
What are we going to talk about next time? What happens after that?
Well, after that, he's not allowed to translate for a little while, and then he's told that he can, but he can't pick up right there, and so that's when he starts translating the plates of Nephi, which becomes the first book of Nephi.
All right.
Which, so, I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents.
Goodly?
Yes.
I guess that's where Bigly comes from.
Yes.
Or maybe that's where my last name comes from. My real last name. I should say my last name is not technically McCool, but it is one of my names now because I am legal.
You're official. Yeah. I'm so happy for you. That's
my name awesome. Is legally Marissa Alexa McCool, and then there's my last name, which you don't need to know.
True story. But yeah, so then. Oh, and then. Oh my gosh, listening to The Atheist Experience, I absolutely love Matt Dillahunty. He had a Mormon call in a couple weeks ago. And he's there talking and he's like, well, Reformed Egyptian isn't a thing. And his caller's like, well, it is in our church.
That's not how this works.
So this guy who came from Jerusalem wrote in Egyptian, but not regular Egyptian, Reformed Egyptian, that isn't hieroglyphs and isn't a thing, and that in itself should be enough to debunk.
Yeah. But when it's all you know.
Yeah. And I guess we can get more into that later because my issues with Joseph Smith have been the hardest to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
So
next time on Doubting Dogma, Molly Un-Mormon tells Joseph Smith to go fuck himself again.
So I guess that is episode 5.
I think it's episode 5.
Wow.
I do. Yeah. It's almost like we did stuff.
Yeah. And thank you guys for being understanding that we missed last week and we're a smidge late this week, but we love y'all. And you can, if you want to be a patron of the show, you can go to patreon.com/doubtingdogma. You can follow me on Twitter at Doubting Dogma. You can follow Riss at Riss McCool, I believe.
Yeah. And my new book is coming out April 21st. And will be
awesome.
It will be first available to
patrons.
patrons, of course.
I win.
And, of course, you can pre-order it through rizmacool.com or my publisher, Wormwood Publishing. And I'll be at ReasonCon. So if you're coming to ReasonCon, I will have a table with both of the books. And you'll have first crack at it. So there we go.
Yay.
Yep. So I'm excited for that. And I'm starting my third book. And I guess that's all that lazy workmanship that I apparently have.
Yeah.
So we'll see you next time when we...
What the hell kind of work ethic is that?
Yeah.
I should really... Three books since November.
Yeah. I'm really lazy. I should
still haven't finished mine.
We'll see you next week. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
The preceding podcast was recorded and all copyright is reserved. The music was performed by Rhys McCool and I did have my permission.